Okay, we're gonna go ahead and get started. Welcome to this session. We'd ask that you all turn, make sure your pagers or cell phones are turned off. During this, it's gonna be recorded. And it's gonna go from 8:30 to 9:30. Session on, an LDS rationale for humane immigration policy by Jennifer Smyers. Jen Smyers is the Associate for Immigration and Refugee Policy with the Church World Service, an international nonprofit organization comprised of 35 Christian Protestant denominations. In this position, Ms. Smyers advocates for policies that benefit refugees and immigrants, urging Congress to treat all people with dignity and respect. Ms. Smyers advocates for increased humanitarian assistance for displaced persons, increased refugee admissions, and humane immigration reform. Recently, she has worked to pass legislation regarding Iraqi refugees, family reunification, and immigration detention center conditions. A graduate of American University with a Master's of Public Policy, BA in Law and Society, and a BA in Public Communication, Ms. Myers has worked with Border Action Network in Tucson, Arizona, and the Immigration Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Besides immigration policy, Ms. Myers is active in a variety of service projects helping youth, homeless, and financially struggling populations in the Washington, D.C. area. She joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on September 25th, 2005, and is currently a member of the Chevy Chase Ward in the Washington, D.C. state. And we will have about 20 minutes of questions afterwards, so I'll let Ms. Myers get started.
Thank you so much, Rachel, and thank you to everyone for being here today. This is my first time at Sunstone, so I am excited and humbled to be with you today. I'm going to go off some notes and ad-lib here to there, but I hope to cut off at about 40 minutes so that we can have a rich discussion and questions as well. So Rachel did a great job introducing me. I just want to expand a little bit on what my organization does. We do refugee resettlement in the United States, as well as helping immigrants reunite with their family members, as well as advocating on their behalf. And that's my job, is advocating on their behalf on Capitol Hill. And it's something that I come to this presentation specifically passionate to talk to you all who are familiar with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We are a Protestant denomination, and we work ecumenically, so usually I just talk about the biblical precedent for welcoming the stranger, so it's really exciting to me to be able to dive into the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants references in that sense as well. So I just want to bear my testimony that I know that God wants us to welcome the stranger, and that's the frame of reference that I take this discussion. So first I'd like to do an overview of three different pieces of past literature discussions that I think will really add to the discussion today. In August of 2007, one of the Sunstone Symposiums, Mary Ellen Robertson, who I know is here today, as well as some others, led a panel discussion entitled Jesus Wasn't a Minuteman, a Dialogue on Immigration and Christian Responsibility. And I kind of thought that title was a lot catchier than maybe mine. But among other topics, they brought to light the very, very real disconnect between LDS doctrine and history, as well as the statements that church leaders have made, and then the LDS politicians and LDS members' stances towards immigration. And also they brought to light the sad reality of worthy church members who cannot attend the temple due to border checkpoints and their fear of being deported. And I thought that was very interesting just in terms of the law of the land versus the law of God and the disconnect there. Then just 2 months later, Rebecca Van Uter published Undocumented Immigrants in the United States, a discussion of Catholic social thought and Mormon social thought. And she really dives into not only the principles of welcoming the stranger, but why we should advocate on their behalf. And she quotes President Gordon B. Hinckley when she says that we should be full participants in the political, governmental, and community affairs, and really relates that to the doctrinal precedent to welcome the stranger and how we need to be doing what we should be doing with that. And then slightly less than a year ago, the panel Mormonism and Immigration spoke about how the U.S. immigration policies are hugely disconnected and are not reflective at all about what we know as the worth of souls is great in the sight of God, Doctrine and Covenants 10:18, nor do they reflect our thoughts as an LDS population in the Family Proclamation to the World, in that all children have the right to be reared by a father and mother because of our immigration policy separating the family. So this paper doesn't seek to overlap or improve upon those discussions at all, but really have them serve as a jumping-off point for our discussion today. So the thesis of the paper, and just to encompass it, is migration is not only the story of 12 million undocumented immigrants in the United States and 24 million forcibly displaced persons worldwide. It is also the story of Adam and Eve, Lehi's family, the Israelites, Mary, Jesus, and Joseph, the saints of the early restored church, and others. This history, coupled with the frequent commandments to welcome the stranger in the Bible, Book of Mormon, and Doctrine and Covenants, signals a standing divine mandate for Latter-day Saints to welcome modern-day immigrants. As an overview of migration, migration is a worldwide phenomenon, starting with Adam and Eve, and we know through restored scripture that it will continue even after the second coming of Christ. Throughout history, people have migrated to flee famine, disaster, persecution, or just to seek opportunity. And global migration is at an all-time high now. Unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment not only in the United States, but in other places as people don't welcome the stranger. To touch on the immigration policies of the United States, which I'll be focusing on, it's evident by the ongoing political controversy here that our system is broken. And regardless of people's standpoints on immigration, that's the one thing I think everyone can agree on. We have visa backlogs that are as long as 22 years for families to be reunited, as long as 7 years for someone to get a work visa to be able to feed their family. We have detention conditions where people are dying due to medical treatment that could be provided, but they're being refused that medical treatment. We have, as a result of our legal immigration policies failing, 12 million undocumented people who are here in the United States, many of whom are children, but all of whom are vulnerable to discrimination, employer exploitation, and hatred from their communities. So the consequences of these things is really shocking. And I think when we look back in our history and even around us now, we're often shocked by the racial undertones of the Civil Rights era and prior to the Civil Rights era. We're shocked that especially religious people express such hatred towards African Americans. And I think that calls upon us a need to examine and re-examine our own language towards immigrant communities, specifically Hispanic and Arab communities, who I think get the brunt of a lot of the anti-immigrant rhetoric. Specifically, and I'll ask for the purposes of this discussion, that we not use the term illegals or illegal alien or illegal immigrant, mainly because it taints the discussion. It makes it not about people, but about something else, some blob of people who are just illegal and they have no purpose being here. We don't call someone with a traffic violation an illegal driver. We don't even call someone who robs a bank an illegal consumer or an illegal banker. But we do use that term for undocumented immigrants. Television personalities are constantly not only using this word, but using a very, very derogatory language to describe immigrants. Lou Dobbs especially is guilty of this, but also Glenn Beck and Bill O'Reilly, who have described Hispanics in particular in terms of swarms, hordes, bringer of diseases, indecent, invaders, and lepers. So this is just indicative of what we're seeing. And as it has become more socially acceptable to vocalize hatred towards Hispanics and towards immigrants, we've actually seen hate crimes towards Hispanics and other immigrant populations increase by more than 25%. So this is a very, very real consequence of ostracism that we're seeing. So my question was, in starting to do this discussion, what do Latter-day Saints believe? And with close to 13 million members of the church, it's difficult to know that entirely, but there are some glimmers of what LDS people believe. So I first looked at LDS members of Congress, and it's really split. You have Senators Harry Reid, Gordon Smith, and Representative Jeff Flake co-sponsoring and voting for very positive pro-immigrant legislation, the DREAM Act, the STRIVE Act, some of the other pieces that would really help the undocumented population. But then you also have Senator Crapo and Senator Hatch voting to strip children and pregnant women who are legal immigrants of health care benefits. So there's a little bit on both sides. Mitt Romney obviously being, I think, the most vocally anti-immigrant candidate, and certainly the most vocally anti-immigrant LDS person that we hear about is specifically comes to mind. And then there are many members of the church who are members of UTONS for Immigration Reform and Enforcement, UFIRE, which has lobbied very hard, not only politicians, but the church, to have anti-immigrant policies. There is a study that talks about LDS attitudes towards immigration. And the hypothesis of the study was that LDS people would be more sympathetic to progressive immigration policies given their history and doctrine in regard to immigration. And this was proven correct. The hypothesis was validated, so I think that's a glimmer of hope as well. In various newspaper articles, church members and church leaders are quoted with words that we should be more humane, we should think twice before we cut in terms of immigration policy because of the human consequences. But even while we see these hopeful glimmers of hope that LDS members do view immigration through a humane lens, it shouldn't shield us from the reality that immigrants and pro-immigrant LDS people are really seeing in their wards and their stakes and around them some anti-immigrant sentiment from members of their own faith. So in terms of LDS doctrine, I wanted to dive into all of the many, many references to welcoming the stranger. And there are a lot. So I might not get through all of them, but we know that the immigration of Adam and Eve was necessary for man to be. And not only for man to be, but for the plan of salvation to take effect. So that's the first course of migration that we see. Literally millions of immigrants follow Adam and Eve in the scriptures. Moses was an immigrant, in fact, the leader of hundreds of Israelites, immigrants through Egypt. Ruth was an immigrant during a time of increasing anti-immigrant sentiment, and Boaz welcomed her amid that anti-immigrant sentiment, and he was blessed, and their offspring became descendants of David, and thus Christ. Joseph of the Old Testament was a refugee who fled his circumstances of being sold into slavery, and then when he was welcomed by the Pharaoh, he actually was able, because of his immigration, to show compassion on his brethren and prevent millions, or at least thousands of people from dying of famine. Lehi, Sariah, Nephi, Laman, Lemuel were immigrants to the American continent and not only integrated well into the society there, but had a strong positive impact on their culture, so much that the Mulekites then became known as the Nephites, and the gospel was able to be spread. Mary, Joseph, and Jesus himself were refugees fleeing King Herod's call to kill all male children. Paul later was deported from many cities and had to flee for his life while preaching the gospel. And during Christ's ministry, he preached numerous times radical inclusion and specifically mentioned immigrants in the parables of the day laborers and the Good Samaritan. We know that through the restored gospel that Lehi and his families were strangers in Jerusalem and in the Americas, and Ammon and the sons of Mosiah immigrated to the Lamanite nation where they lived and taught for years. As a Jaredite refugee, Coriantumr was found and welcomed by the people of Zarahemla. And the stories of immigrants in church history, which we'll get to later, really continue this flow. So from these doctrinal truths, we can develop our views of immigration and subsequently immigration policy through a humane lens. The specific reference to strangers is the most common reference in the Bible. It's actually the most cited commandment in the Bible is to welcome the stranger. And it's often followed by ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. As Latter-day Saints, we are also required to imitate the righteous concern of God, who doth execute the judgment of the fatherless, the widow, and loveth the stranger in giving him food and raiment. Love, therefore, ye the stranger. Repeatedly, the Lord commands us to not pervert the judgment of the stranger, and the most commonly cited scripture in terms of immigration is Matthew 25, where the Lord not only says that we are to welcome the stranger, but later on in that chapter, he ends with really saying, if you don't welcome the stranger, if you have turned away the stranger, then you've turned me away, and you shall go into everlasting punishment. But the righteous who have welcomed the stranger shall go into life eternal. And a colleague of mine often sums this up as, welcome the stranger or go to hell. So I think that this is particularly appropriate, and that verse is very close to my heart. So then we see, and my favorite Book of Mormon reference to immigration is 2 Nephi 1, verses 5 through 7. And I'll just read it because I don't even want to ad-lib it. It's beautiful. But, said he, notwithstanding our afflictions, we have obtained a land of promise, a land which is choice above all other lands, a land which the Lord God hath covenanted with me should be a land for the inheritance of my seed. Yea, the Lord hath covenanted this land unto me and to my children forever, and also all those who should be led out of other countries by the hand of the Lord. Wherefore I, Lehi, prophesy according to the workings of the Spirit which is in me, that there shall none come into this land, save they shall be brought by the hand of the Lord. Wherefore this land is consecrated unto him whom he shall bring. And if it be so, that they shall serve him according to the commandments which he hath given, it shall be a land of liberty unto them. Wherefore they shall never be brought down into captivity. If so, it shall be because of iniquity. For if iniquity shall abound, cursed should be the land for their sakes, but unto righteousness shall it be blessed forever. And this, to me, just encompasses so much. Not only should we welcome the stranger because we know they are brought by the hand of the Lord, but also, if the stranger is brought down into captivity, then it shall be for iniquity. And I think that it really sums up really what we're doing in our immigration policy right now in terms of bringing down immigrants into captivity. So not only in these scriptures, but in modern-day Revelation, prophets have spoken of the gathering of Israel, and specifically how important the gospel is to share with the Lamanites. Heavenly Father has given us commandments to immigrate, and therefore, when we think about immigration policy, I think we should think, are we preventing people from fulfilling that prophecy and that commandment? In his speech in 1976, Elder Fiennes, I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce his name, but he discusses multiple prophecies in modern-day revelations that cite the importance of bringing Lamanites into the fold. He goes on to discuss the importance of preaching the gospel to our brothers and sisters in Central and South America. And through intense missionary work, we've seen this go very well. But I think it's interesting that there is such an emphasis on going to South America, going to Central America, and preaching the gospel. But while those very same people are next door, are in the grocery store line with us, we perhaps roll our eyes or complain about why don't they know English, or we don't seek to reach out to them. And I think that it's a glaring hypocrisy. So I think that when we also look at when missionaries are not able to preach the gospel in another country, I think the reaction of many LDS members is, oh my goodness, how could this be? This is horrible. We don't have access. And I think it's a certain entitlement that not necessarily members of the church, but that the people in the United States have, that we should be able to travel to go everywhere. And I think there's a cognitive dissonance to that, and what we do in terms of our own borders and exercising unrighteous dominion over those borders. So that's the doctrinal part, but then the LDS history is very, very rich in terms of immigration, and I think this section was about probably an hour of me talking by itself, so I've had to cut it down a little bit, but I want to talk about immigration and the restoration of the gospel, because I think this is something that often goes overlooked when we talk about the restoration of the gospel. We know that the United States was chosen by Heavenly Father for the restoration to take place. And we often talk about how it was a prime place for the restoration due to its emphasis on freedom of religion and a lot of the religious movements that were going on at the time. But also, it would have been impossible for the restoration to take place and for the church to grow as it did without the lax immigration policies that the United States had at the time. And first and second Great Awakening, which led to the restoration of the gospel because people were talking about religion and it prompted Joseph Smith to ask of God which church was true. These movements would not have been possible without the wave of European migration in the 1700s, immigrants bringing with them various traditions and views of Christianity. Without lenient immigration policies, the restoration would be very different in this way. And then also in terms of the immigrants who came and helped the restoration begin and built Zion and migrated with the saints, that would have not been possible at all without our lax immigration policies at the time. In fact, when we talk about freedom of religion and freedom of movement as being the catalyst for the restoration, seeing that the freedom of religion didn't really go that well for us, facing persecution and being forced to be immigrants, I would say that freedom of movement was actually a much, much more loyal friend to the Latter-day Saints than was freedom of religion at the time. And I think that this should... When we look at this, we also need to focus on the early converts today who face persecution in their home countries and immigrate to the United States or elsewhere. And I think it should motivate us to keep the United States an open and welcoming place for newcomers. Because not only does Nephi say they're brought by the hand of the Lord, but we know that the restoration would not have been possible and the building of the church would not have been possible without our lenient immigration policies. Obviously, the early saints were immigrants. Joseph Smith was one of the many migrants to Palmyra through the Mohawk Valley, and at the time, their family, to me, very much mirrors migrant laborers. They had to work odd jobs to secure a livelihood, making buckets and barrels, serving as carpenter's helpers, starting home business, making tablecloths and meals, and I think that some of the trials that they faced in being migrants in that area is very, very consistent with the lives of migrant workers today. And then in the early years of the Restoration, Joseph Smith and the early pioneers were certainly refugees. After the early points of the Restoration, lax immigration policies proved vital to the church, and really the ability of the church to gain economic and even political consequence in the United States. The commandment was to come to Zion. And Brigham Young is quoted in many letters saying that coming to Zion, that immigration is second only to baptism and the fulfillment of sacramental covenants in terms of proving one's faithfulness to the gospel, to build Zion. And I think that is certainly of huge worth. The early converts were encouraged to come to the United States. In fact, Brigham Young's guidance brought more than 103,000 Latter-day Saints to the United States just in about 50 years. And when we look at those who converted to the church, most of them were also immigrants as well. So not only did immigrants who were already converts come to the church, but many of those early converts were people who had just recently migrated to other countries. And I think that the way that the LDS Church treated immigrants at the time really should serve as a model for us in how we treat immigrants today. And it was really astounding to me just to see the lengths and the economic and or the financial and the social sacrifices that the early saints made for these immigrants. Brigham Young even commissioned the Deseret Alphabet to be written, and this was new news to me, but it was a phonetic version of the English language that was commissioned for the sole purpose of immigrants trying to learn English. And Brigham Young said, you know, our English language is crazy, it's very, very hard for people to learn, so we need to have this phonetic version. And it was technically the official language in the church for a few months in the 1860s. But the reason that it wasn't needed was because members of the church were welcoming people so much, bringing them into their homes and teaching them English and taking that time to welcome them, that it was just an incredible integration policy and one that I really think that our country could maybe learn some lessons from. But not only that, the Perpetual Emigration Fund, which I'm sure all of you are familiar with, this was for immigrants to come to this country, and it funded a full or partial payment for their travel fees. At the turn of the 20th century, 20 to 50% of LDS immigrants received either private or PEF funds in order to earn their fare, and most immigrants who came arrived from their country to the United States, either to New York or somewhere else, and actually stayed there for at least a year to earn the funds that it would take them to purchase wagons and to head out west to build Zion. And in today's terms, these people were migrant workers. They were low-skilled immigrants. They were not here for any reason in New York. They were looking to go out west, and they had to just earn their keep at the time. But we embraced them, and we welcomed them. And I have this wonderful quote from someone who was not LDS, but who was on a ship that was carrying both LDS and non-LDS immigrants. And he said, "The ordinary immigrant is exposed to all the chances and misadventures of a childish, mannerless crowd during the voyage, and to the merciless cupidity of land sharks, the movement has touched the opposite shore. But the Mormon ship is a family under strong and accepted discipline, with every provision for comfort, decorum, and internal peace. On his arrival to the New World, the wanderer is received into a confraternity, which speeds him onwards with as little hardship and anxiety as the circumstances permit, and he is passed on from friend to friend until he reaches the promised home." And I thought that that was very heartening, and I think should reflect the way that we welcome newcomers today. Now, some might say that the reason that we welcomed these people was because they were LDS, but really, many people who are not LDS, but were just immigrants trying to make a living in New York, or once they came to Utah or out west in general, they were assisted by the church. And I don't know how much of that was in hopes that they would convert, but even today, the church is sustained in the United States through a much larger baptism rate of refugees from Southeast Asia than even in U.S.-born persons. But a more important point is that the Lord is not a respecter of persons. And the Lord doesn't care if you are a convert, or if you are immigrating for various reasons. He loves everyone and wants us to provide for everyone, and we see that doctrinally, specifically. It's also important to note that due to persecution and factors of convenience, many LDS immigrants did not come in a documented way to this country. And the reason that we might know this is because we know that polygamy was practiced in the church during the time of a heavy rate of migration to the United States. And I want to read this list. It wasn't until the 1790s that we actually started barring certain people from immigrating to the United States. And this list is: any alien, being a free white person, may be admitted to become a citizen of the United States. And later it was added: all idiots, imbeciles, feeble-minded persons, epileptics, insane persons, persons who have led one or more attacks of insanity at any time previously, persons of constitutional psychopathic inferiority, persons with chronic alcoholism, paupers, professional beggars, vagrants, persons afflicted with tuberculosis, you get the idea. But down farther is polygamists, or persons who practice polygamy, or believe in, or advocate for the practice of polygamy. So even if people were coming through a legal channel, it was widely known that the Mormons did practice polygamy in this time, and either they lied or they came illegally. And we know that many of them certainly did. So it is no wonder that because of our peculiarity as a people, LDS immigration was frowned upon by many non-LDS persons at the time. And due to this and also other things in terms of the church being more stable, the Building Zion Where You Are talk given by Bruce R. McConkie was given in 1977, which was the official, you don't need to come here, we're not really enforcing that 10th article of faith as much anymore, and you should build Zion where you are. But in heavy periods of LDS immigration, early saints must have felt similarly to what Hispanic immigrants feel today. And I think that this is really what we need to focus on, is how did our people feel? And as well, after the passage of the Edmonds Act in 1882 that forbid polygamy, many LDS people fled to Canada, which, because of its lenient immigration policies, they were able to find refuge there. The United States is where so many converts learn about the gospel as well, including those converts who could not learn about the gospel in their home countries. Many of you may be familiar with the story of Kim Ho-jik, the first Korean convert to the LDS Church. In 1949, Kim traveled to the United States from North Korea, where missionaries could not travel at the time, on a student visa, and he learned about the church. He then returned to Korea and was key in opening South Korea to allow LDS missionaries in. His family was baptized, as have been many Koreans, due to the United States encouraging immigration and travel visas. And I think that that is really indicative as well. So I want to get into policy. And given the doctrine and the history that we're seeing, what should be the policy that we advocate for? And I think there is a struggle between living the law of God and living the law of the land. And we have seen the church really speak out heavily against UFIRE, which are the Utahns for Immigration Reform and Enforcement. UFIRE was saying, well, because of the 12th Article of Faith, you shouldn't allow undocumented immigrants to attend church, to attend the temple, to serve missions. And they said, no, that's inappropriate. Everyone is allowed the blessings of the gospel. And so we do have to say that we don't encourage people to break the law. But when we have a law that separates people from their families for decades, that is abusive, that is not working, we have to reform the law. And I think that that is our responsibility, as President Hinckley has given us that responsibility to be involved. And to reform the law, at least five things must happen. First, the visa reform system must be completely reworked. So to get rid of the backlogs, to process the backlogs, and to make sure that family unity is essential to our plan. The next, due process must be restored, and the detention of immigrants must cease, and those detention conditions where they are needed need to be improved. All workers must be provided equal rights, and we must ensure that our border policy makes sense as well. Right now, we're not allowing for cyclical migration, which is a human phenomenon that needs to be taken into consideration. And then the key central point to immigration reform is in regard to undocumented immigrants. And that's the heated debate in Congress that we're seeing right now. And I think when we look at the system being broken that is encouraging undocumented immigration, we shouldn't ask, it shouldn't be this back and forth, you know, should the law be enforced or should it not be enforced, but how should we enforce our laws? And many proposals advocate making undocumented immigration an aggravated felony, which is a charge not even used for convicted rapists or thieves. Is this appropriate for people who have overstayed a visa or crossed a border to feed their families or be with their families? And I would say no. I would say that we should enforce our laws but make them proportional for each violation. And that undocumented immigrants should be able to perhaps show that they've been paying taxes or pay back taxes, show that they have maintained a criminal-free background, show that they're providing for their families, and start a process that would allow them to be granted lawful permanent residency. And then once you have lawful permanent residency for 5 years, you're allowed to apply for citizenship. So many of us in the LDS Church are already doing something to help immigrants around us. Many people serve missions, and when I talk to the BYU interns who are up here in D.C., I always kind of hit them hard with, it's interesting to me that when people serve a mission, or when you're hearing someone talk about their son or daughter serving a mission, and they talk about these wonderful new converts, and they have so much faith, and they're so wonderful, and the missionaries come back, and they love, and they care for these people, but I think it's unfortunate that if that person's brother is behind them in line at the grocery store or is working with them at a local factory, suddenly that person, instead of being loved and regarded, becomes the person taking our jobs or the person who can't speak English or the dirty Mexican. And I think that that certainly needs to be changed. There are wonderful things going on across the United States. One LDS chapel in San Marcos, California, encourages members and non-members to seek legal help with their immigration paperwork. And this has been criticized by UFIRE, and it has been defended by the church as this being a proper and important thing to do. In a ward in Nogales, Arizona, half the people of the ward are undocumented, and the other half belong to the Border Patrol. And they worship together, and they serve each other in visiting and home teaching with no questions asked, and they attend the temple together. They are able to recognize each other as human beings, even in that polarized environment. My favorite instance of the church standing up for immigrants is there was a Lou Dobbs special, and Lou Dobbs was slamming the church. I think that President Vicente Fox of Mexico was going to meet with Governor Huntsman, and he said, of course that would take place because the Mormons encourage all the illegal aliens to come to the United States. And did you even know, he was talking to Anderson Cooper, did you even know, Anderson, that they have 20 churches in Mexico, the Mormons do. So the church, which usually doesn't get that involved in things like that, actually released a press statement that said, you know, we don't encourage anyone to come to the United States illegally or legally. And Lou Dobbs mistakenly mixed up our churches, which are regular church buildings, and our temples. We actually have 20 temples in Mexico, but we have more than like I don't know the number, 5,000 church buildings in Mexico. So it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek, yes, we do have church buildings in Mexico. In his April 2006 conference talk, The Need for Greater Kindness, President Hinckley stated that racial strife still lifts its ugly head. I am advised that even right here among us, there is some of this. I cannot understand how it can be. Now I'm told that racial slurs and degenerating remarks are sometimes heard among us. I remind you that no man who makes disparaging remarks concerning those of another race can consider himself a true disciple of Christ. And this was commented on by a columnist in the Salt Lake Tribune, Paul Raleigh, who said, it's interesting that President Hinckley is making these remarks because it was the same week that a lot of these anti-immigrant ordinances were coming up in Utah and as Congress was considering federal immigration reform. And he specifically said that he felt that Hinckley's remarks at this time, while I think most people perhaps associated them with African-American racist sentiments towards African-Americans, were actually by and large for anti-Hispanic comments. And President Harold B. Lee expressed similar sentiments to this when he said there is no room for discrimination in the church. We are having come into the church many people now of various nationalities. We in the church must remember that we have a history of persecution and discrimination against our civil rights and our constitutional privileges being withheld from us. Those who are members of the church, regardless of their color, their national origin, are members of the church and the kingdom of God. And I think this is really vital. And then he goes on to say, now we must extend the hand of fellowship to men everywhere, to those who are truly converted and who wish to join the church, to partake of the many rewarding opportunities found therein. I wish we could remember that. And while the LDS Church has not taken political stances officially on this and has said that they don't, they have been vocal in a few ways. They sent Elder Russell Ballard and other church leaders to meet with Utah legislators asking for cooler heads to prevail in the consideration of restrictive and discriminatory policies. Church spokespersons have met with community leaders. And then later, Marlon Jensen of the Quorum of the 70 stated that the legislators should slow down, step back, and carefully study and assess the implications and human costs involved. With decisions hanging in the balance that have such significant consequences, I believe a more thoughtful, not to mention more humane approach is warranted. Immigration questions are questions dealing with God's children. Legislators should measure first before they cut. And he later stated that the church's view of someone in undocumented status is akin to a civil trespass. There is nothing inherently wrong about undocumented status. And I know I'm going to wrap up in just 5 minutes here, but what other religions are doing to advocate for immigrants is really out of this world. And I don't just say that because I'm working for one of those organizations, but helping refugees resettle, meeting refugees at the airport, teaching them English, giving them job training, helping them find a job. The Catholics especially have huge campaigns and legal clinics to help immigrants you know, just with all of the paperwork that they go through. We work in an interfaith immigration coalition where I guarantee every faith is represented except my own. And specifically, World Relief, which is the humanitarian arm of the National Association of Evangelicals, perhaps an organization that you wouldn't think would be involved, is very, very strongly involved. And the leaders of these faith movements speaking out, giving press conferences, talking to members of Congress and organizing really helps bring conservatives on board. And we need to do a lot of work in helping, especially Senators Hatch and Crapo, as well as some others, make good decisions in this regard. So in terms of recommendations for the church, and I'm sorry that I'm cutting this a little short, but what should we be doing? We should be doing refugee resettlement. Of all the churches, we have the most access to people who speak other languages, especially languages that are hard to come by in the United States. So the fact that we are not helping in this regard just blows my mind continually, because I work with 35 different Christian denominations who are doing it, and they need these languages incredibly, incredibly much. We should advocate for inclusive policies, because we know that our policies are broken. We already do, actually, the church already does advocacy for some immigration matters that would affect missionary travel and visas for missionaries in the United States and outside the United States. So we need to broaden that advocacy to advocate for everyone, because everyone's immigration policies and the access to immigration for everyone really does have an impact on missionary work. We need to just have a better welcoming attitude. We need to defend immigrants and correct people who have misconceptions of immigrants in our wards especially. We need to take leadership, have more speeches from the leadership of the church, and reach out to Mormon politicians. We need to talk about it in Sunday school. When we talk about Pioneer Day, we need to talk about the parallels with modern-day immigrants. And we need to consider where our church stands in terms of movements like the New Sanctuary Movement and others that are helping refugees and immigrants avoid deportation and separation from their family. So that is where I will end and open up for a couple minutes of questions. Thanks.
You mentioned that legal immigration policy doesn't account for cyclical migration. What is that?
Thank you. Cyclical migration is when there weren't as many enforcements along the border. People would come during avocado season to pick avocados, earn enough money to help their family through the rest of the year, and then they'd return and stay with their families. Same with orange seasons, different seasons, mainly agricultural. And people would go, they would earn enough money, and they'd come back. When we started enforcing the border, that stopped. And then people would come because they still couldn't feed their families. They still needed to pick those avocados to earn even a meager wage. But now they couldn't go back and come back. So now they're there, and they're either separated from their families for a long period of time, or they become undocumented, and then they're looking for jobs during the rest of the year. And it's a detriment just in terms of economic policy, because we need people to pick avocados and to pick tomatoes and to pick oranges, and as well as much other seasonal work, but we're not allowing that to happen because we don't have any seasonal worker visas that are available.
Can you talk about a policy of whether branches and wards should be, you know, fully Spanish, fully Asian, is that hurting or helping? Should it be mainstream? Where should the church go on that?
Yeah, there's a fantastic book that's called In His Own Language that discusses some of that, and it is written by someone who is Hispanic and in the United States. And it is contentious, and I'm not going to presume to have all of the answers there. I think it should be a preference of the individual. So I think there should be a preference if they want to go to a ward that is fully Spanish, if they want to go to a ward that where there maybe is translation of some of the hymns or some of the books available, but people speak English so that they can help learn the language. There's a great program going on here in the district, in our Spanish ward. They have a program where people who are English speakers and people who are Spanish speakers can get together and help each other learn both of the languages, which I think is really fantastic. I would recommend that book and kind of say, I don't necessarily want to make someone's decision for them, but I do think that there have been problems in church policy in regard to this. Spanish wards having bishops who don't speak Spanish, for example, being one of them. And I think that needs to be sorted out, and people need to have a better a say at the table who are actually impacted.
Have there been attempts to involve the church in these interfaith coalitions that you're a part of? And what is the reasoning for not being a part of that?
Well, it's interesting. When I first joined the organization Church World Service, I saw that the LDS Church was involved in some of the religious worker visas that we worked on. And I emailed the person who I knew was working on it, and I said, hello, you know, we'd love to have you more involved. And I never heard back. So I don't know if that is official, or it's just he's busy, or he just thought I was a crazy person. But in terms of officially inviting the church to the table, that has not been done, and I think one of the reasons that it hasn't been done is people are sensitive. For example, the Baha'is have not been invited either because they don't take political positions. And I personally feel, in discussions with some of my colleagues, that actually we might want to invite the church to the table in more recent events, seeing that they are being involved in other types of policy. So I think that's something that we have gone back and forth on, and we should invite them to the table in a more formal way. I don't think they would be involved because it is such a contentious political issue, but I think that some of the things that we're seeing are there gradually progressing to that point.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you say, but this is some more a comment and some of the other question, but I think that at the beginning when you asked us not for evidence, that was the illegal way, and I can certainly understand that and appreciate that. But But I think it's unfair to then turn around and group kind of everybody's opposition to these things as like anti-immigrant policies without distinguishing between them. I mean, I think there are a fair number of people that are interested in enforcement of current laws that would probably agree with you that prospectively lobbying changing the laws is entirely valid and something that I've done. In fact, I imagine those Border Patrol people attending that board that you mentioned, you know, most of them are probably like, sure, let those people in, but as it is right now, the law stands, we have to enforce it.
Sure.
You know, I mean, and I think by grouping everything that like Mitt Romney says or Craig or everybody says as anti-immigrant unfairly kind of makes them appear to be implicitly racist or just hate these types of people. And I think a lot of what they say is, sure, let's have a lot more legal immigration, but as of right now, the law is this, and therefore we need to enforce it.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And there are two points I will make. One is that I think the reason that myself and many immigration advocates have a little bit of that knee-jerk reaction is because people like Mitt Romney and Crapo in particular have said, oh, I'm for legal immigration. But then they repeatedly vote against legal immigrants. We recently saw this with the S-CHIP bill, where it's only legal children and legal pregnant women who are lawfully present in the United States, and they were voted against by Orrin Hatch and Senator Crapo. So I think that is one thing that is our knee-jerk reaction. But that being said, you're absolutely right. And I always say there are three types of people who disagree with me. And there's one type of people who it doesn't matter race, it doesn't matter anything, they're just talking about the law, they're just talking about security, that's just their mindset in terms of policy. I think the second type of people are people who are misled by the media and by a lot of the anti-immigrant sentiment, people who watch Lou Dobbs, who don't really know any better but feel like something's wrong and feel like immigrants just need to be deported. And there's a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment that is anti-legal immigration. We shouldn't have any more illegal immigration is what FAIR and Numbers USA and some other anti-immigrant groups will say. And I think the third group are the people who are hateful, who are racist, who come at this from a hateful perspective. And my fear is that that third group is coercing that second group and feeding them lies and fear and hatred. And they're allying with that first group to get their agenda passed, not only in terms of undocumented immigration, but in legal immigration. But I appreciate your comment, and I think that that's absolutely true.
Yeah, I mean, just to follow up, I mean, I'm speaking in my personal capacity, but I'm an attorney at ICE, actually, so, you know, group. I mean, I think there should be a lot more legal immigration, but the law is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that to expand and kind of advance your agenda, if you could bring people, like me, my colleagues, people onto your side by not necessarily grouping us into the crazies or the racists, would be a lot more receptive than you guys have to say.
Absolutely, and I will tell you that. I mean, we work very closely with people in the administration on the NSC and ICE and CIS and elsewhere, and we don't group you guys in the racist category, but I definitely understand that could be seen as being such, and I agree, it's something we should be more careful about.
I'm a little bit curious about the transition that we as a church have made. We talked a lot about how we helped people, immigrants, in the early church, but now our kind of general sentiment is we don't have any business messing with immigration. And I'm curious what the intersection is. Did we flip the switch? Were there a few definitive events that made that happen? Or was it a slow progression?
It's interesting. I think that at the time, when I talk about the early saints as immigrants, there was this huge desire, heartfelt desire and passion, really, for new converts and for missionary work to be done. And it was a full force effort. And now we've seen the church is a little bit more stable, we've got more people, and I think there is a lax in our missionary work. Just to comment on that, and I know my husband here is assistant ward missionary, so no criticism for you. But I think that there is some pushing, some leaning back, and saying, oh, we don't have to be missionaries anymore. And I think that when we talk about every member missionary, we should talk about that. There's no greater urgency than there is now to build the kingdom and to spread the gospel. And I think that is first, but also secondly, that sometimes leaves a bad taste in my mouth because Christ didn't just reach out to those people who he thought were easy converts. He didn't just hang out with those people who had already accepted him or he thought were really close to doing so. And I think that when we look at our past attitudes towards immigrants and our now attitudes towards immigrants, I think we've seen it was a bunch of us who were coming in, and that's why we welcomed them, or a bunch of potential us's. And now it's people who maybe there's more difference there, perceived difference, and I think we need to shirk that and to say we need to welcome everyone, whether they're a member of our church or not. So I appreciate that question.
I have a question on the difference between sort of the institutional church as the entire church versus what may happen on the local level, because I think there are very few, particularly political or social issues, on which, you know, the church written large at large actually engages. On the other hand, there's a lot of discretion to respond to local needs. For example, when I was a state employment specialist, we had a woman that's a paralegal in an immigration law firm in Maryland who came and gave a fireside in the Spanish board about how to get legal status and maintain legal status. But that was in response to a need in the local area. I know there's immigration attorneys that are members of the Church of Chicago that serve as advisors to stake and ward leadership in that area because they happen to have members of the church who are immigration attorneys, which we don't, unfortunately. I'm only aware of one in the greater metro area. So I guess I feel like there's a lot that can be done at the individual level at individuals and local unit initiative, and that the church encourages that kind of initiative in a variety of areas to meet human needs, including immigration, where, you know, you have the resources and where there's the need. So I guess I question why the church should take, it seems like you're advocating for the church writ large taking a much more vocal and visible role on this issue, when the truth are there are dozens of social issues out there which it has chosen not to take a formal position on, other than perhaps press statements like Marlon Jensen, or, you know, in a sidebar, sending people to talk to a member of Congress.
No, I absolutely agree. I think that there's a lot of great work being done, and especially by some employment specialists. In our own state, we had a similar event, and that I was really pleased that it happened. However, there are things going on in local churches that need the church to come down on it as well. For example, stake presidents and bishops asking in temple interviews in the "Do you obey the law of the land?" asking people their immigration status, and we know that is not appropriate. But does the church really condemn that as much as it can publicly? And I mean, there's all these different things that do happen. So I agree that local communities should and do a lot. But I also think that the church as a whole needs to make sure that we're not only serving our population, but we're serving. I mean, the bishop of every ward has jurisdiction over the spiritual and temporal welfare of everyone in that area, not just in their ward who's LDS. And I think that we need to make sure that we are advocating. That can really only happen federally, from a church level overall. And I think that we need to make sure that some of these negative things aren't happening and some of these good things that are happening are church policy overall. So, I mean, immigration's my issue, so of course I'm going to be biased that the church should be waving the flag for it. But I do think that it's time for the church to be involved as a whole, as well as for those local movements to be extended. And I think we may have time for two more questions.
In this country historically that whenever there's an economic recession, we have anti-immigration sentiment. That there's a relationship between the economy and our feelings about immigrants. And I think that started in the 18th century with the Alien and Sedition Acts and went through the potato famine, and I would expect that things are going to get pretty grim and right now for immigrants. And I just wondered what kind of, right now in this snapshot of history, what you see happening, what do you expect with the new Obama administration, and what do you expect in the kind of near future, the next 5 years?
Very good and very tough question. It's absolutely true that immigrants get blamed for anything. I think when the stimulus package came out, I don't know who all here reads The Onion, but there was this pie chart of where the stimulus package was going to go to, and about a fourth of it was going to immigrant-blaming literature. And I think that's very true. I think in terms of the economy, we have to focus on, and this is really tongue-in-cheek, but there was this anti-immigrant report that is saying, it's such a good thing, because now that the economy is collapsing, all the immigrants are going home. And I read that, and I said, actually, that's pretty much supports my stance in that immigrants are here for economic opportunity and they're not a drain on the economy. They adjust with the economy. And so if the economy is doing poorly, then they will seek opportunity elsewhere. They're not staying around and hanging out without a job. And I also think that when we look at who is maintaining their jobs, we are seeing a lot of immigrants vital to the production of especially construction industry, service industry, agricultural industry, who are maintaining their jobs because even the 6% unemployment rates in some parts of the country, people don't want those jobs. And these are often legal immigrants and some undocumented immigrants. So I think that that has to be taken into consideration. I would say that if we want to improve our economy, one of the best things we can do is take the 12 million undocumented population and allow them legal status. Because then we can ensure that they are all paying all of the taxes, which many of them are already doing. We know that from the Social Security Administration, but are all can be paying taxes and can be making sure that they get a fair wage. And people will tell me, well, immigrants take our jobs, so I don't want to legalize them. And I say, if immigrants are taking our jobs, which I don't think is the case, we need to legalize them. Because if someone is being able to pay an immigrant $3 an hour for work and then has to pay a U.S. citizen $5 an hour for work, or I guess $6 right, an hour for work, then the immigrant certainly has an advantage. But as soon as we legalize that immigrant and make sure that they have to be paid an equal wage and not be exploited by further employers, then the playing field is then level. And there isn't that type of unfair competition for people who are being exploited. In terms of the Obama administration, we have met with them on four separate occasions to talk about refugee issues, asylum issues, overall immigration issues, and specifically family immigration issues, which is a priority for my organization. And they are very, very supportive. I think there was just an article out yesterday about Napolitano doing a study on border policies and the inefficiencies of them. And I think that we will see a greater focus towards the enforcement of human trafficking laws and drug smuggler laws versus just your everyday person who's seeking to make a living and be with their family. So I think that we will see that. I think that it is tough. It's tough. We're hoping to see immigration legislation sometime this year or next, but we'll see. I think that's it for us. Thank you so much.